conversations with leading CEOs. Welcome to the Ari Zoldan Show, where you'll be able to sit in on conversations with leading CEOs, executives, and founders of some of the most innovative and cutting-edge companies of today. You'll learn about blockchain, cryptocurrency, clean tech, and other industries that are pioneering the new economy. Ari brings his years of experience as an on-air TV commentator to the mic for a packed dialogue of education, information, and in-depth interviews. It's all here, right now. And here's your host, Ari Zoldan.
Welcome back into the studio right here, 710 WOR, the voice of New York, and anytime you wish, day or night, on the iHeartRadio app. I am excited to be in studio today, as usual, yes, but today for a very specific reason. I personally believe and live by the mantra that everything happens for a reason, that timing happens to be everything. And one of my biggest fans, my biggest supporters, my whole entire life has been my dad. And for the quote unquote luck of the draw, my niece had a baby recently, and that caused my father to travel in right now to be here from Florida and be in New Jersey. So I said, wait a minute, you're going to be in town today? I'm going to be in the studio. You must come along. So this is really like a once in a lifetime, because aside from being my biggest fan, my biggest supporter, my biggest rock throughout my entire career, which involved, as you may know, 15 years as an actor and filmmaker in this great city of New York, through all kinds of performing and trying to find my way on the entrepreneurial path, basically, I've just been trying to follow his lead. He is David Gartenberg, but let me explain even further. It's David Carey Gartenberg. I am Josh Carey. That's a whole story for another time. If you can put two and two together, Dad, you're here on the mic. How are you?
I am fine and very, very proud of this moment. I really am. Traveled up. My granddaughter gave birth, made me a great grandfather. I'm born and raised in the city of New York. Here I am back home, living in Delray Beach, Florida now. Love to get back to the city. The Big Apple still is my home in my heart.
Now, what's amazing, Dad, is that we always joke in our family that whatever comedy we know, whatever shtick and performing we do at the dinner table, we blame you. We said, well, we just get this from you. You wanted to be an actor, a performer, or a DJ, and certainly some of your direction in life suggests all that, that it all is a level of performance. But what was that wish?
As the youngest child, I remember at a very young age, I was listening to a radio station back in the 50s, and I was listening to it with a young girl I was with. I must have been about 11 years old or so, and I said, I always wanted to be a disc jockey. She looked at me and she said, in all honestly, she said, I didn't know you liked horses. I said, no, a disc jockey on the radio like we're listening to.
Wow.
And I've had that dream for a long time. I was on stage a little bit, but needless to say, not professional, just amateur, and just enjoyed it. I loved being in front of audiences, and I'm thrilled that you picked up my mantra.
It would only stand to reason, wouldn't it? We could certainly spend all day getting into your life story. I do just want to hit on for a minute. We're in New York City. We were driving in from New Jersey. The last time you were here was 4+ years ago. You were commenting how things have changed. Paint the picture just for a minute. You were practically raising yourself on the streets of New York in the 50s, just like out of West Side Story, with nothing, right?
That's exactly right. But just live and learn, I guess. Just had to do it. You had to survive. From shining shoes on the streets is what I had to do. Helped support a family at 9 and 10 years old, shining shoes. Rent was $29 a month. And I used to bring home $1 a day from shining shoes. So at 9 years old, I consider myself that I was helping pay the rent from just a mother at home. Father wasn't around. And just had to learn the streets and survive. That's basically it. And here we are today, still surviving.
we certainly have to get you back on the mic for a fuller length life story, but leave us with the one piece of advice that allowed you to get from those extremely modest days of under 10 years old, entrepreneurial, right? You knew you had to make ends meet, so you found ways to do that. You never stopped in your life. In fact, you were able to finally, in your early 40s, after never giving up and trying and trying and trying, you succeeded, built your own empire, and were able to retire recently. But what are those missing pieces that we can take away of how that's even possible?
Just believe in yourself. Just believe in yourself. You must continue to fight day in and day out. It's all survival. Just believe in yourself.
I love that. I love you, Dad. So good to have you here. It's a real pleasure, a real honor. Once in a lifetime, like I said, just turned 79 recently, and I value every minute we have together because that's what life's about. Thanks, Dad.
Do your show.
Thank you. I'm going to do my show, which, for the record, I've been doing the show. We're not going to minimize that because that was all good part of the show. Now, on to today's guest. It is Catherine Vaxey. Now, there's so much fascination to do with Catherine. She is the chief strategy officer and general counsel for Genprex, which is a biotech company publicly traded under GNPX on the NASDAQ. I've gotten to know Catherine and her CEO and the company very well over the past few months. They're extremely successful in the gene therapy angle of things. She's going to tell us more. Catherine, so good to finally have you in New York on the mic with us talking today.
Well, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here and happy to be here with your dad and hear his inspirational story.
Yeah. Tell us first what Genprex does as a biotech company.
Sure. Well, we are a gene therapy company. We are pioneering gene therapies for large patient populations. So our two programs are in cancer and diabetes. In cancer, we have two clinical trials underway for our gene therapy drug, Recorsa. And that's in combination with a drug called Tagrisso, which is a top drug of AstraZeneca's. Lung cancer kills 1.8 million people annually, and it is a treatment that where it's a disease that people are in desperate need of new and better treatment options. Our other program is a diabetes program. Diabetes, about 11% of the U.S. population suffers from diabetes. That's about 37 million people, and it at this point has become an epidemic in the U.S. and worldwide, and only getting worse. So these large patient populations with such serious diseases, with no adequate treatment options to allow them to live their life at all and enjoy the life that they do live, there's a real need. For our two oncology clinical trials, we have received fast track designations from the FDA. The FDA grants those designations in cases just like this, where you're dealing with an unmet medical need, as there is in non-small cell lung cancer, and where new treatment options are needed because the current ones are not adequate. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to help these people with these terrible diseases have better treatment options and maybe even cure them.
I understand that most biotech companies fail, which is really in line if you're going to do the math and look at the stats of most entrepreneurial endeavors. But if we're talking about biotech and life sciences, if most fail, what's allowed you to even succeed this far? Because it seems like there's a lot of success. And I know you have more of a road to get to. But what do you account for that's allowed you to get to this amazing, amazing level?
Well, I've been very lucky, but The heart of biotechnology is science and good science at the major institutions in the world, and these incredible innovative scientists who have ideas of new ways to understand biology and to treat different diseases. So there's for Genprex, there's 15 years of preclinical work in the laboratory identifying the gene we're currently using in these two trials I'm speaking about, which is the TUSC2 gene, which is a tumor suppressor gene. So it's taken years to identify that gene and more time still to deliver it. So it's the great science that that's the backbone of these companies. And it's everyone isn't a genius, and companies run out of money because it's such an arduous road. All sorts of reasons why biotech companies start and don't succeed. But I'm thrilled with Genprex because of our technology, which is just unique and promising and just elegant. And we've had, even though we're at a phase 1/2 trials, which are on the early stage, it's been shown to be very safe and seeing nice effectiveness. So it's what's the science behind it and who's the team behind it. And those are great for us. And I have been lucky enough to have a prior big success in biotech. And, there's no feeling like that. I'm a lawyer, so I love science, and I was just lucky to get involved with this. And when you get to develop an important drug helping very sick people whose families are desperate, it's just tremendous. Yes.
We're going to get to your past 25 plus years in the industry. Help us understand, paint the picture of what cancer treatment was like then versus now. Let's say 40 years ago versus now. Where have we come?
Well, the history of cancer treatment, it's really pretty surprising that many of our standard treatments today have been used since the 1940s. Chemotherapy, radiation surgery, which is basically burning it out, poisoning and cutting out the cancer. So, and that works. That works sometimes, but there are people in my industry believe there are new and better approaches. And what has happened as science advances, specifically with gene therapy, the human genome. I think we all heard about the human genome being sequenced 20 years ago. And what that meant was identifying what the function of all the genes in our body do. So you're able to have a more advanced approach, a more tolerable approach, quality of life, and hopefully longer life too.
Is the goal or an outcome to, in 20, 50, 100 years, to sort of eradicate those older fashioned approaches? Or will there always be a place for those and the gene therapy approach?
Well, I would let the scientists and the medical doctors give a definitive answer. But certainly the hope is to eradicate. And as science advances, we learn more and more about the biology, I think that's possible. I mean, certainly our diabetes program, we have licensed in two genes that have been found in preclinical studies. Those are studies in animals that are not humans, that these genes have been able to turn alpha cells into beta-like cells. Beta cells produce insulin, but the body's immune system attacks them. So these genes have been able to make them into beta-like cells, so they're not attacked, and they're delivering insulin to the patient. And, you know, the people who know better than I do, the scientists and the MDs, think that this could remove insulin dependency from for diabetics. So, yeah, it's potentially huge and really exciting.
Speaking of huge and really exciting, you're a pioneer, an innovator, certainly, in this industry, more than two decades strong. One of the earlier companies where you were an executive, ImClone, right? A great exit there. But talk to me about which was revolutionary when it happened in the early 2000s, where there was a $1 billion licensing deal.
Well, I was very lucky. I was a little bit of hard work and a little bit of luck to my very first company was tremendously successful with a drug called Erbitux, and one of the first what's referred to as targeted cancer therapies. So that those are drugs that are addressing the biology and not just poisoning, burning or cutting out, but actually understanding the biology. So I was lucky enough to be part of one of those very early companies, and that Erbitux today, last I checked, sells about $2 billion per year. It's helped a lot of people. So it was a tremendous, tremendous time.
And there was a $1 billion deal for Bristol-Myers Squibb to license it, right?
Yeah, so that was at the time, and this was the early 2000s. It was the first billion-dollar deal in biotechnology history. I mean, today, biotechnology deals at $1 billion are commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, it was a really big deal, and basically it was the recognition, as I see it, of big pharma, of these more advanced treatments that, wow, look, they appear to be working. And they made huge bets. And in this case, it was a big payoff.
And there was something interesting about the day that the deal was originally set to go. What happened there?
Well, it was quite a day. It was 9/11 here in downtown Manhattan, and our office happened to overlook the World Trade Center.
And what was set to happen that day in the deal? You guys were meeting?
Our board was meeting to approve the deal. So, you know, and that was basically the finalization of the deal to announce it. And it behind us, the Twin Towers were falling. So it became clear fairly early on that the deal was not going to happen that day. But I am proud that one week later, downtown New York was closed. We signed the deal. We were committed. It was going to be a great deal for the company and for patients, and signed one week later. So,
well, where did you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island, Sayville.
What was that lifestyle like?
Well, Sayville's a lovely seaside community on the Great South Bay. It was my dad who was from Brooklyn. It was in those days, the 30s and the 40s, it was a vacation spot, sort of like the Hamptons today. My parents decided to move there and raise a family there. It's a beautiful little town, bucolic, just a great upbringing. My parents were great and supportive and inspirational and great role models, and my brothers and I have all gone on to do some pretty interesting things, I think. So
you started out becoming, and you still are, an attorney. You went that route from college, right out of college. Were you always, as a younger adult, were you looking for that path? Was that inevitable for you, that you always wanted to go that route?
Well, I was always driven from being a young person and through today. I was just always driven and wanted to find something great to do in this world. And I always loved science. I didn't really see a pathway forward for science other than teaching, which wasn't really my interest. Teaching is great, but I didn't see it for myself. I was more entrepreneurial, and I went to law school, St. John's University School of Law, and basically studied business law with the idea that I'd come out and work in entrepreneurial endeavors. And I was just super fortunate to have my first job, which was right after the stock market had crashed in the late 80s, was with a life science company representing biotech companies. And so here I am.
That's amazing. What about the idea that it's not common for a woman to be in this industry, especially for your length of time? Is that right?
I would say at the executive level, there are a lot less women, though, like many things, that's changing. Certainly, I think coming up through the ranks, the scientists and the technical people who are the engines in this business, it's more dispersed. But there haven't been a lot of women who are my colleagues, but that's okay. I love my colleagues, even though they're men. I just keep going, and I'm sure there'll be more women as time goes by.
Let's talk about Genprex specifically for a minute, because you've certainly have succeeded in the path you've been looking to go on. What is the next 12 to 18 months? Where do you go from here?
We're talking about Genprex?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have underway our two clinical trials. We brand them Claim 1 and Claim 2. That's in our non-small cell lung cancer programs. That data from those trials is really important and key for us right now. And that will be unfolding. Our phase one portion we expect to be completed by the end of this year. So data from those trials are key. And then also advancing our diabetes program, we're looking forward to taking this technology and getting it into people, getting an IND filed with the FDA, and getting authorized to move into treating people.
And what's the end game?
Well, in biotech, we're the innovators, we're the risk takers, and that's what we're looked for. I think in drug development. And we, first and foremost, we want to help patients who need it. But as a business, we want good data. We want good data for everybody, and big pharma will take note and come in. And they're the ones with the deep pockets. They're the ones with, little biotech doesn't typically become Pfizer. We're not looking to grow into however, employees. Pfizer has, 100,000 employees. So typically it's a licensing deal, a buyout at some point in the company's life. But we're first interested in realizing some great value for our shareholders by proving out our programs.
Tell me about the value for the shareholders. What should they know? What should an investor know about coming into the Genprex family?
Well, the lawyer in me says to go read our SEC filings, which will tell you everything that's important. But the industry, your risk, it's a riskier area to invest in. But I've sought to detail how the promise and the excitement of it. And that's the human part. But the financial part is in drug development that translates into increased stock price and money for everybody. So
wonderful. You're doing amazing work. I've always been impressed with who you are, what you're doing, and how you're doing it. Getting to watch you week after week alongside of you following the path and the journey. It's genprex.com, GNPX on the NASDAQ. Catherine Vaxey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Josh.
Listen to conversations with leaders of some of the most innovative and cutting-edge companies on the Ari Zoldan Show. You'll learn about blockchain, cryptocurrency, clean tech, and industries pioneering the new economy. It's the Ari Zoldan Show, Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. right here on 710 WOR.
And you're listening to the Ari Zoldan Show, 710 WOR, the voice of New York and iHeartRadio. Sitting here in studio with us is Renee Grogan. She's the Chief Sustainability Officer at Impossible Mining. Renee, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, I got learned a lot the past couple of minutes about seabed mining. If you could explain to our audience what that is.
Sure. So the seabed is broken up into two main zones, exclusive economic zones, which are inside the country's waters, and international waters, which is referred to as the high seas. And both of these areas have mineral deposits, so metals of critical, what we call critical minerals. So these are rocks that contain cobalt, nickel, copper, the kinds of metals that we use to make electric vehicle batteries, wind turbines, solar panels. And the size of these resources is really significant, very large. They dwarf most of the resources on land. And as we're thinking about transitioning to a green economy away from fossil fuels, we need lots of these critical metals to create the infrastructure that I just referred to. So the discussion around seabed mining is really, should we access these metals? And if so, how? And if we don't, then how will we provide the metals that we need into this new green economy?
And if you were, you know, what comes to mind, Renee, is Greenpeace. If Greenpeace was sitting at this table around us, what argument would you have for them?
It's a great question. And Greenpeace is coming from a place of environmental concern, which is completely understandable. And we support their concerns. I think the messaging around seabed mining, firstly, has been pretty one-sided in that the concept of what's called dredging the seafloor or almost vacuuming up the seafloor is what some of the players in the seabed mining space are proposing to do. And that's what Greenpeace is extremely concerned about. And we share those concerns because there would be huge damage to biodiversity and ecosystems on the seafloor if that technology was used. What I would also say is that there are other ways, firstly, to access these metals on the seafloor that are potentially much more responsible from an environmental perspective. But the second thing I would say is that if you would propose to ban seafloor mining, because of the size of the resource on the seafloor, you really need a very strong plan B, as in where else are you going to get these metals from if not the seafloor? And we know that the largest resources of nickel, for instance, are located in countries like Russia and China, where we have some fairly serious geopolitical concerns. We don't necessarily have a secure supply chain. And if the seabed is considered off limits, then there really needs to be something else on the table. And I'm not sure that that's entirely been thought through.
Do you think the authors of the climate bill really thought this through?
I think the climate bill highlights a really important issue around what we call ESG, so environmental, social, and governance issues related to critical minerals. So the climate bill talks about not accessing minerals from places like Russia and China and Indonesia. And these restrictions relate to ESG concerns. And so I think that's really important to highlight. But again, it means that if you're restricting resource access in this way, you need to have another plan on the table. Otherwise, we're just simply not going to have enough of these metals to transition us to a low carbon economy.
And let's talk about the mineral, the metals, specifically nickel. To the average day person, where, how, when do we use nickel?
That's a great question. So nickel is predominantly used to make stainless steel. So anything in your life that has a steel component is using nickel. So that comes down to cars, electronics, the structure of your house. Copper is another really critical metal, and it is used to make electric wiring. So anything that you use that has electric wiring, water pipes, these sorts of things are embedded in our everyday life, and we absolutely take them for granted, which is fine until access to them is restricted, and then you start to see some really big challenges arising.
And what's the relationship, Renee, with Tesla and, let's say, nickel, explaining how kind of nickel plays a part in the Tesla vehicle?
So Tesla and its compatriots in the electric vehicle space, but in fact for all vehicles, use nickel because they all use stainless steel. Electric vehicles also use nickel in the battery, but also conventional vehicles use these kinds of metals in their batteries as well to some extent. So access to nickel for a company like Tesla or Ford or GM, or indeed any of the companies that produce things like wind turbines and solar panels, is really critical for two reasons. Firstly, they need to know that they can get access to the metals to build the products, but they also need to know that they're going to have access to that commodity with a relatively stable pricing. And that's something that we're seeing change dramatically, for instance, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You see the nickel price increase so dramatically that it causes this knock-on effect with these kinds of manufacturers who now have to absorb those cost increases. And that is part of what's driving an instability that we need to address.
So is there always a correlation with between any type of macroeconomic events that are occurring around the world and the nickel metal space?
It depends on where those resources are located. So China and Russia are big producers of nickel. So any kind of political fractions in those spaces is going to cause an impact. In other metals like copper, where they're slightly more diverse geopolitically, you don't see the same kind of trends. But in the mining industry, the metals price is also driven by demand, like everything else. And so, as we know at the moment, the demand for these metals is increasing exponentially as we transition to a green economy. And the supply is certainly not keeping up. And as we look at options for increasing the supply, we have to consider both the geopolitical stability of where those minerals are located, but also the ESG side of things. And so it's quite a delicate balance. And to come back, I guess, to Greenpeace, we fully support their objective in terms of delivering an environmentally responsible solution to the supply chain issues. But it's a far more complex discussion, I think, than the one Greenpeace is currently having.
Can the nickel supply industry, is it conceivable that that it dries up?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, there are new mines coming, what we call coming online all the time, but the average time to permit a new mine varies, but it can be sort of between 7 and 10 years, depending on the jurisdiction. So once you identify a resource, you still have to go through a really long permitting process in order to get access to that resource. And the nature of the resources, you know, we started mining the land 150 odd years ago, and like most things, we took the easy stuff first. So we mined out all of the deposits that were easy to locate, that were really high grade, that didn't come with a lot of risk. And now what we have left are lower grade deposits that come with higher risk, because when you move, lower grade means there's just more waste rock for every bit of valuable nickel. So when you have a lot of waste rock, then you have to store that waste rock somewhere, and that becomes an environmentally risky situation, because those landforms are sometimes not stable, they can fail, they can hurt people, kill people. And we have these resources now that are not in easy to reach places. They're because of the low grade, they're sometimes quite marginal economically, and they take a long time to get permitted because of the increased risk. So yeah, I think it's conceivable that we're going to have some really significant pain in the coming years if we don't start to consider, okay, we have this resource on the seabed. It is hugely vast compared to the size of land-based resources. If we wanted to access it, how would we do that in an environmentally responsible way? And can we progress on that basis and have a type of seabed mining progress that is environmentally responsible? Otherwise, I think, yeah, we're facing some very serious supply chain issues.
Mm. And talk to me, Renee, about some of the locations where has the heaviest concentration of seabed material.
Sure. So the biggest nodule deposit, so nodules are small potato-shaped rocks. They sit on the seabed, so they're not connected to the seabed. You don't have to cut or drill or anything. You can just pick them up, basically. And the biggest deposit of that is in an area called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. It's in international waters, and it's between Mexico and Hawaii. So it's off the coast of the United States. That particular resource alone contains four times the total global resource of cobalt and the equivalent total global resource of nickel. So it's such a vast resource that it would change the economics of the metals market, unlocking access to that resource. And it would also go a considerable way to providing geopolitical security for access to those metals.
Is there any mining taking place now?
No. So that's in international waters, which is governed by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and a body called the International Seabed Authority implements the treaty. They are currently developing the regulations to provide the framework for assessing and regulating seabed mining in international waters. That process is not yet complete. So until the regulations are written and finalised, the seabed mining jurisdiction outside of exclusive economic zones can't go ahead.
So you're saying that the framework is still yet to be constructed, and I assume it would be a complex one because of the different countries that are involved, or is it two countries that are involved, Mexico and
No, Hawaii? it's the full signatory parties to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So that's 168
wow.
states. Of which the United States is not one because they're not a signatory to UNCLOS. So that is quite a complex process, you're right, and it's been going on for quite some time now. The expectation is that it will be finalised by July of next year, but that's not necessarily guaranteed. And then the other thing, I guess, to note is that there are deposits of these minerals in what we call exclusive economic zones, so inside the waters that are controlled by the nation states. So for instance, the Cook Islands has quite a large deposit of nodules within their exclusive economic zone, and they are also developing the regulatory frameworks to allow for consideration of mining those metals.
So that's going to open up an entire new industry, I suspect, not only of mining of the product, but also job creation.
Yes, absolutely. So these are all, this is, I guess, part of the complexity of the issue. And what I advocate for is really strong thought leadership on considering environmental, social and governance issues associated with seabed mining, and then looking at those same issues for land-based mining as well, and having a really considered approach to how we access the metals that we need for this transition.
Are the EV companies, do you think, and they may now, I'm not sure, are they investing or do you think they'll be acting as a mining company or making investments in different mining companies to secure product through their supply chain?
Yeah, the way that car manufacturers are approaching the supply chain is certainly changing, and that's reflective of the risk in relation to both gaining access to those metals, as I said, and having some sort of security over the price of those metals. So yeah, we are seeing car manufacturers take a stronger interest in the supply chain, which I think is a positive step. What we really need to see is the mining industry itself really lifting its standards in relation to how it accesses those metals, so that we can create a link between the metals on the seafloor or in the ground and the consumer in a way that gives the consumer confidence that the metals that they're purchasing have been responsibly sourced.
And talk to me about impossible mining. What are, as the Chief Sustainable Officer, some of your roles and responsibilities within the organization?
Sure. So impossible mining was born from this idea that the seabed minerals may well be really critical to the transition to a green economy, but that the dredging technology that's currently being considered by other players is potentially extremely environmentally damaging. So at Impossible Mining, we're developing underwater robotics that allow for the rocks or the nodules to be picked up one by one, and the sediment that they sit on remaining undisturbed. So there's huge biodiversity that lives in that sediment. So we think it's really critical that the sediment ecosystem remain intact. And our system also will be using artificial intelligence that allows us to identify organisms or life forms that are living on the rocks and to leave those rocks alone. So they remain untouched and the life forms on them also remain untouched. If that works on a large scale, it will be the most sustainable form of mining anywhere in the world ever. And this is why I think it's really important to start having a conversation about how we access metals from wherever we access them. And in the context of a 21st century where your consumers care more than they did 20 years ago about the footprint that they have on the planet, I think giving consumers access to metals that have been mined in a really responsible, transparent way is something that I feel very strongly about.
It's incredible. This has been a, maybe it's not a coincidence, but our next guest, Michael Isikoff, who you met coming in, also is, he's in the robotics space, but you guys sit in a very interesting area of ecology, ESG, mining, robotics, AI. And it's amazing. And the mining industry, you know, no one knows better than you, hasn't really evolved or changed in some time. And I think this is a real interesting, I think, turning point for the industry.
Yes, so do I. I've been in mining for about 17 years and I came in as a young female in an industry that was old, full of old men and had a really old school way of thinking. So from my perspective, it's an industry that's absolutely ripe for disruption and change because we haven't seen a lot of that in the last 4 or 5 decades.
It's incredible, and you're certainly on the forefront of it. So how can people reach you?
You can contact me through our website, impossiblemining.com. There's a contact page, and you can make contact with me that way.
Amazing. You've been a great guest, Renee. And this is the Ari Zoldan Show, 710 WOR, the voice of New York and iHeartRadio.
Listen to conversations with leaders of some of the most innovative and cutting-edge companies on the Ari Zoldan Show. You'll learn about blockchain, cryptocurrency, clean tech, and industries pioneering the new economy. It's the Ari Zoldan Show, Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. right here on 710 WOR.
And you're listening to the Ari Zoldan Show, 710 WOR, the voice of New York and iHeartRadio. I am here with David Brill. David works for Voyager and excited to have him at the mic. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm great, Ari. How are you today?
Good, good. So tell me a bit about Voyager.
So Voyager is a retail platform to purchase cryptocurrency. And what we enable our customers to do is go through a very easy-to-use app and purchase over 100 different cryptocurrencies. So it's a really simple process. You can download the app in the App Store. You can, connect your bank to our API, and then you can go in and choose from 100 different cryptocurrencies. So our goal is really to make the user experience easy, to make it accessible for customers, and for customers to purchase the digital assets that they want.
When did you start the company, and what's been some of the challenges that you've encountered over the past 12 months?
Sure. So the company was started in 2017. And I would say in the last 12 months, the real challenges relate to scaling. Because as you know, the crypto industry is growing exponentially. And there's so many different great products and great opportunities and great protocols. So one of our goals is to make sure that we continue to provide our customers with the protocols that they want to be involved in. and to make sure from a legal and regulatory standpoint that we're being compliant while we do that. So it's really kind of a race with innovation, but also being doing it in a compliant manner.
And what's your, David, what's your best definition of a stablecoin?
Sure. So when I think about a stablecoin, Ari, I think about a stablecoin that's backed by assets, and traditional assets being treasuries or similar assets of the like. I think of a stablecoin that has an audit, a stablecoin that is audited and that somewhere is responsible for that. So for instance, at Voyager, we work with USDC a lot, and that's US dollar coin, and that's run by Circle. And Circle is a US-based company. The stable coins are audited on a quarterly basis, and you can have a real tangible sense of what is backing the stable coin, whether it be treasuries or other assets, and whom you could go to redeem that stable coin. So that's how I think of it. Now, there's a second type called an algorithmic stable coin. And as you may be familiar, the Terra Luna UST situation was an algorithmic stable coin. And an algorithmic stable coin really is a pool of assets that are run by algorithms to make sure that they don't move from their peg of $1. And in the case of UST, it feels like there wasn't enough time to develop that algorithmic stablecoin, because when they had a run on that stablecoin, unfortunately, the peg did not hold up. And unfortunately, users of the UST ended up being liquidated or having a stablecoin that's worth less than a penny. So there's a real difference between a mature, tested stablecoin and one that is sort of still being developed. And I think it's important that the ones that are being developed, the algorithmic ones, really, they spent a lot of time doing that. Because at Voyager, we weren't comfortable listing UST because we didn't feel it was mature enough and we weren't confident enough in its ability to keep the peg. So therefore, we didn't list UST on our platform.
Makes sense. And tell me, David, about Voyager's plan for expansion in Europe. What does that look like?
Sure. So we believe that there's a real focus on retail, and retail investors and consumers want to have access to our products. So we are in the midst of a plan to expand overseas. You know, we're looking to be in Europe at some point this year. We're also looking to be in Canada as well. And so really, again, taking our user-friendly UI, our user interface, and giving other customers in different countries an opportunity to have a crypto experience in a very user-friendly way.
And what does your team look like? Who is it comprised of? Some of their core strengths, and what makes Voyager's team unique?
Well, I think we have a really interesting combination of people with expertise in trading. Our CEO is from E-Trade. You know, we have experienced people who have worked in financial services. Like myself, I've worked in financial services for over 20 years. Our general counsel has been in financial services for over 20 years. We have senior people in compliance and also senior like a CFO and other people and technologists. So we're really taking a blend of the old technology and the sort of online trading and then blending it with the crypto expertise. Like I run the crypto listings group. I'm the co-head of that. So I have a deep knowledge of individual cryptocurrencies, protocols, trading. So I leverage my deep knowledge along with the teams to determine which products we think we should list and which ones we think are best for our customers.
Amazing. And David, talk to me about competition.
Sure. Look, there are some established players in the space. We have, you know, some large, well-known exchanges, you know, ubiquitous ones like Coinbase and FTX and some of the other ones. And so I think this is a big enough pie for a number of quality exchanges to exist. We're more of a brokerage. They're more of exchanges. So there's a difference there. But like ours is really retail focused. We want to make this accessible for everybody in retail and have a good experience doing it. And so that's our mantra as we build out our products and, you know, expand globally.
And you seem like you really have a good understanding of European regulations. What is it that makes Europe different or more dynamic or more accepting to this type of environment versus the U.S.?
Well, I think from a legacy standpoint, you know, the way our constitution is set up in the U.S., there's states' rights and there's federal rights. So there are some things like the securities laws that are preempted on a federal level. Then on the state side, you have money transmission laws that are driven on a state level. So that combination in a now more global world where you're not just conducting business in one state or two states, but in a global ecosystem, it just makes it a little more challenging because you want to be on sides with both the state and federal regulators. Whereas in a Europe, you typically have one regulator that governs for the whole country. Like the UK has regulations, and it doesn't matter if you're in Liverpool or in Oxford or in London. It's one set of laws that govern the country, whereas ours are more decentralized, both on a federal and state level.
Mm. And when do you think, in your estimation or your prediction, when we're going to kind of come out of this challenging market conditions that the U.S. and, quite frankly, you know, the world is challenging?
So I think there's three things to look at. With regards to crypto in the first instance, if we were to have an ETF approved, now Grayscale has their ETF that is supposed to be voted on or approved or not by early July. So I think if we were to have a Bitcoin ETF approved, I think that would lead the market forward. So I think in that is something very interesting that's coming soon. I would say the second thing is really we have macro issues involved right now, both on a, you know, on a world level. So we have issues of a war in Europe, which I don't think many people foresaw. And then we have, you know, we still have COVID around. So when you have a war going on, which is still unpredictable, although we think it's only going to be Ukraine and Russia, but it could expand. And then you have COVID, which suddenly shuts down two major cities like, you know, Singapore and Beijing, and affects the whole global supply chain. It's hard to see a market moving forward against those headwinds.
Right. This has to kind of clear through, and we kind of need a purger.
Yeah. We need to get some closure on this. So I think the same way
closure is a better word.
We want closure for the war in Europe, clearly.
Right away.
And obviously, we want to eradicate COVID as soon as we can.
Yeah, I think those I agree with you. I think once those two challenges are behind us, and hopefully they will be soon, things I think will open up relatively quickly.
And so I think if those two things were to resolve, the view of risk assets will be different. But speaking specifically to crypto, it's macro elements, and then maybe a potential ETF. But if not, I think it will take a few months to work through the system like it's taking for stocks.
Yeah.
And so, but I do want to remind your listeners that, you know, Amazon in 2000, I think was at its high of like $75. At the below in 2001, it was down almost 99%. So I think there just has to be a little recognition that these things have happened, and now Amazon is, you know, one of the five, I think, biggest companies by market cap. So there have been these times where things have moved dramatically, and then they've turned the corner and moved higher.
Yeah. No, to your point, I think you're 100% right, and you certainly seem like a real expert in your space, and that's what you need, I think, for someone to drive a company forward. If you've been tuned in, you've been listening to the Ari Zoldan Show, 710 WOR, the voice of New York. And David, how can people contact you?
So our website's investvoyager.com. We encourage people to come and look at the website. You know, we welcome people to test it out and see if they like it, and we think it's very user-friendly. So we encourage people to test it out.
Amazing. David Brill, thank you for coming on the show, and enjoy Consensus.
Thank you, Ari. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Listen to conversations with leaders of some of the most innovative and cutting-edge companies on the Ari Zoldan Show. You'll learn about blockchain, cryptocurrency, clean tech, and industries pioneering the new economy. It's the Ari Zoldan Show, Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. right here on 710 WOR.